Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. Oil stores energy. So does a battery. Technology-driven economies all over the world are investing heavily in battery research because batteries are a key technology in more efficient, more sustainable energy-based economies.
The reason people are now interested in lithium air batteries, which is this technology I'm talking about, is that they're starting now to realize that lithium ion batteries have limitations that will be a real challenge for the auto industry to make electric vehicles possible. And whereas the industry is struggling to get to 100 miles on a single charge, this technology will allow you to go up to 1,000 miles on a single charge.
Wow.
The same weight equivalent battery. So the implications are very profound.
Lonnie Johnson invented the Super Soaker water gun. He has used the small fortune he made from that invention to create and develop leading-edge energy generation and storage devices. How does one man go about changing the world? Dr. Lonnie Johnson, some years ago we sat on the shores of Cape Elizabeth, right where Champlain had landed before he went up into Canada. And our host was talking about who dominated the sea, because we were talking about Champlain. And he talked about how there was a long stretch of time when people who had mastered using wind were dominant. And then he talked about how next came steam and then the age of fossil fuel as the driver. And I'm thinking about this because it seems to me some of that same progression, not exactly, but some of that same progression kind of fits the work that you're doing, and maybe the next great leap is, in fact, the sun.
Well, the sun would give us, certainly solve a lot of world problems as an energy source, because you know, our standard of living is tied directly to consumption of energy. You know, energy to help us do our daily chores, our work, to make our lives less stressful, and even enable us to do things like read at night, because we have adequate light. So we can be a lot more productive. And so energy enables a lot of things. The problem is that when energy costs too much, then as we start paying for that, we can't pay or provide productivity toward other things. And so we end up shipping our wealth offshore, as we have been for in recent times. And so if we can harness the sun, which is the ultimate source of sustainable energy, which is renewable and won't destroy the environment, then of course the whole world can prosper and focus on other things in terms of improving the quality of life.
You talk about the sun. I think it was Tom Hartman wrote a book years ago called, I don't know, something about ancient sunlight. But what his point was that even the materials we're using now, the petroleum, is a consequence of sunlight. It's just it was there for a long time. So what we're doing is digging up and using up ancient sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it will run out. But the other part of it, you mentioned the cost. The cost is more than just an economic cost.
Oh, absolutely.
It's the environmental consequences, the toxins that get pumped into the atmosphere, global warming or global climate change, more to the point. All of those things are factors. And the challenge, of course, is that you have boldly stepped up to is what you're going to do. And it's important.
That would be a technical term.
That's a technical term, yeah. I learned that as an engineer.
Well, it's more important than that, you know, because as the world starts to, third world countries and other less developed countries start to lift themselves out of poverty and consuming more and more energy, it starts to choke the supplies and the sources. And so we start seeing conflict and more strife over, you know, those energy sources and trying to acquire them for diverging interest.
Well, we saw John Lewis just after
Congressman John Lewis,
just after the United States had invaded Iraq for the second time, and he said, you know what this is about?
Oil.
And this was when there was still lots of fluffery about all the things it wasn't about.
But it also, I mean, you can see it in the First World War, you can see it in the Second World War, you can see it going, the British presence in the Middle East that has had grave consequences. We're paying a very high price for this.
Right.
And the challenge is, and in some ways the surprise is, Americans are very proud of our ingenuity and our intellect and our resources. What is surprising is that you're having to do it, that it hasn't already been done. Mm-hmm. How can that be, with all the resources we have available to us, that you're, and which is not to say you're alone, but you have been toiling in the wilderness for something that you would think we would have been smart enough to do something about it before.
I think it's fair to say I've been toiling in the wilderness because for a long time I had a difficult time getting people to listen to me, and if it were not for my own resources, I wouldn't be at the point with the technology that I am right now.
Let's take a quick break so that we can come right back with Dr. Lonnie Johnson. We're going to talk about what those resources were. We're going to talk about what he did with them in just a moment. We're back. Dr. Lonnie Johnson has joined us in conversation. Bill Russell, I'm Paula Gordon. Please give us a quick overview of these things that it's been tough to get people to see, and then we'll talk about how you funded it. But first, I want to get a picture of what the current work is that you're so committed to.
Well, I'm working on advanced energy technology, which turns out to be very timely right now. It turns out I've been working on this technology for over, now that I think about it, it's been a very long time. I say well in excess of 20 years, but more recently in the CAT class of technologies that I'm focused on right now, the battery work started about 12 years ago. The more advanced battery started another about 8 years ago. So there are two different battery technologies, mm-hmm. one a little bit more older and more mature than the other. And then there's the energy conversion technology that converts heat directly into electricity. And that one would be applicable to solar energy as well as any other heat source, waste heat from industrial processes, geothermal heat, wherever there is a heat source, this technology could be useful.
These are all pretty radical leaps from where we are just sort of in the regular marketplace to where you can take us, aren't they?
Yeah, they're very radical and
but radical in the good sense.
Oh, in the good sense, that's right.
Well, unless you happen to be Exxon.
Oh, dear.
I mean, there's a political piece to this.
Well, for example, the engine, it offers higher conversion efficiency than any other engine that's been built before. My engine, it converts heat, as I indicated, directly to electricity.
Now, when I hear engine, I hear clunkety, 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 clunk, and it's the big thing, and right. You've got to have something to make it fire, and. So engine, to me, is a word that speaks to an old way of thinking. Using it in the big science sense, aren't you?
Well, yeah, yes, I am, in a technical sense, in the sense that engines, thermodynamic engines work, usually there's a working fluid, a gas, that you compress at low temperature, you heat it up and expand at high temperature. Your car engine works that way. You pull in ambient air, compress it, you inject fuel, heat it up to high temperature, and expand that gas at high temperature. You get more work out during the expansion than it takes to compress it. And so that excess work is what you use to turn the wheels on your car, or you can turn a generator to produce electricity, and even the generator itself is a mechanical device where you have a shaft and you're turning rotating shaft in a magnetic field.
So these are all engine.
Energy is a way of converting, an engine is a way of converting energy to work.
Right, heat energy generally. So a internal combustion engine, you burn the fuel to get the heat. If you want to burn a fuel and supply it to my engine, you could indeed do that. You could burn the fuel, supply the heat to this engine, and this engine would give you electricity directly.
But
it has no moving mechanical parts.
Which is a tremendous departure from what I think of as engine.
Yeah, it's a huge step forward. It does operate on a thermodynamic cycle. It uses hydrogen as a working fluid. It compresses hydrogen at low temperature and heats it up at high temperature, and you do the high temperature expansion. So in that sense, it's a traditional thermodynamic cycle. But it works on the, what's called the Erickson thermodynamic cycle, mm-hmm. which is equivalent to Carnot. So in the ideal sense, the efficiencies would be very high. Obviously, in the real world, there would be friction and some losses, but because this has no moving mechanical parts, those losses will be much less than what we normally would see.
Well, I think of that. There's a classic perpetual motion machine that for years somebody would come up with a perpetual
motion. Well, perpetual motion means that you're not supplying a source of energy. The source of energy in this case is heat. So we are supplying heat in and we get electricity out.
Right.
If you had a perpetual motion machine, well, a perpetual motion machine is any machine that would just turn and run forever without anything coming in. Even if you could get one to work without taking anything out,
that's
an accomplishment.
It's taking it out. And, of course, the inefficiencies, the friction, and all the other things.
Yeah, so
I bring that up because the no moving parts.
Yeah.
Right.
Of this is a very, very important piece.
It is an intriguing technology. It's one that I've run into a lot of skeptics, and fortunately, I've had my own resources, and I've been able to move it forward.
Okay, let's fess up. Talk about the resources. We'll get it out of the way. You made a lot of money with something quite improbable that may even surprise people sitting listening to the scientist. What did you do?
I invented the Super Soaker water gun.
Super Soaker is something that an awful lot of people with kids and a lot of people who don't have kids.
That's right.
Know a lot about.
I feel the ideal toy is one that the adults want to play with as well as the kids.
And then they did, which has made it possible then. Because what you're talking about, none of this stuff is trivial. All of it's hard, and all of it costs a lot of money to fool around with, doesn't it?
That's correct. Absolutely.
So, thank you, Super Soaker. Which takes us, as I listen to the two of you using what are, for me, right at the edge of understandable words, you're talking about a revolution in an awful lot of realms when you're talking about an engine with no movable parts, radically advanced battery technologies.
Yeah, the battery. This is lithium air battery technology. We've had a lot of people now have come out recently, large companies. IBM, for example, has made public announcements of a technology initiative to bring lithium air battery technology to fruition.
But they're trailing you.
Yeah, they announced this maybe a year and a half ago, something like that.
Which would be around 2009 or 2010?
Yeah, 2009.
And you have working, not even prototypes, you have things out in the field that are being used.
Not in the field. No, we don't have anything in the field. We have working cells in the laboratory where we're cycling them, charging them, and discharging them. But more important than that, we're developing the other enabling technologies that will allow us to put these cells in the field.
So you can't just walk out and plug something in. You got to do a lot of stuff that goes with it.
Oh, yeah. There are a lot of components. We've had to develop new materials that didn't exist before.
Materials.
Right. Materials that had certain, like a glass electrolyte, for example, a solid glass material that can be applied cheaply and easily to coat a separator so that we can use that glass to protect lithium, but yet the lithium ions can be conducted through it so that they can then react with oxygen on the other side.
Now, I'm going to feel more comfortable when you tell me that all these things are patented and we can talk about it.
Yeah, we have patent applications pending on some of them. Some of them we have patents actually issued, and we have other patents that are in draft, and I will steer away from those.
No, please. I don't want to get in trouble.
I want to be able to share this with somebody else.
Well, all of these things are important because you are, and we talk about people at the leading edge, you're at the cutting, bleeding edge, aren't you, with a lot of these things?
Well, you know, the car, for example, the battery. The reason people are now interested in lithium air batteries, which is this technology I'm talking about, is that they're starting now to realize that lithium-ion batteries have limitations that will be a real challenge for the auto industry to make electric vehicles possible. And whereas the industry is struggling to get to 100 miles on a single charge, this technology will allow you to go up to 1,000 miles on a single charge.
Wow.
The same weight equivalent battery. So the implications are very, very profound.
Talk a little bit about those challenges, because I don't think that's familiar to most people. the challenges in the existing battery technology.
Okay, sure. The first challenge is cost. Lithium-ion batteries are expensive for the amount of energy you're able to store in them.
The current ones?
The current ones. Mm-hmm. For example, the battery for the Prius or Toyota Prius is about $10,000.
Yes, I know.
And it's worth it.
Mixed.
Imagine that battery costing $1,000 mm-hmm. to get you the same range. So that would be a very attractive and enabling thing that would allow other people and more people to afford electric cars. So when you look at the projections right now for the adoption of electric cars, and people talk about how many cars will be on the road by 2020 time frame and so forth, well, those projections are based on existing technology, and they'll make some improvements and estimates based on anticipated improvements. But those analyses generally don't account for a radical or paradigm shift in the technology.
What kind of shift?
Paradigm.
And what you're talking about is a paradigm. You're talking about lithium air as opposed to lithium ion.
Correct.
And what is it that makes the air piece so much more appealing than the ion piece?
Well, the expensive component in lithium battery, lithium ion battery, is the cathode material. It's a metal oxide. The most popular one right now is a lithium cobalt oxide, which is cobalt, and that has its own issues. There are cheaper materials, manganese, which is more friendly to the environment and more available. But even then, these metal oxides are heavy and they're expensive, and incorporating them in the battery has burdens associated with that. And the other one issue is the weight of the battery. Once you get it and you construct it, you're at about 200 watt-hours per kilogram of battery weight. So when you put this in your car, to store enough energy in the battery, that means you've got a heavy battery.
Which means you're spending a lot of the energy
moving the battery around,
which means it's effectively lost energy.
Right.
This is not a good thing.
And so as you try to get a bigger battery in your car so you can drive further, it costs you a lot more money, but now you've got a bigger and heavier battery, and so you reach diminishing returns. Your range increase starts to taper off.
Mm-hmm. However, when we come back, we will talk about the good lithium battery that uses air, not ions, or something like that. Be with us. We'll return, and he'll explain it to me. We're back with Dr. Lonnie Johnson, Bill Russell, I'm Paula Gordon. We're talking about this exquisitely new technology that you are developing. It didn't come from nowhere. This idea of a lithium battery has been around a while.
Right.
And yet you
lithium
saw something
air.
Different.
Right. A scientist named K.M. Abraham first did a test on lithium air batteries. I believe it was back in the 80s. And then
That would be the 1980s.
That's right. It basically lay dormant for a period of time. And then there was another researcher named Jeff Reed who did some work on it and then published a paper, and then it languished. I didn't know about this. In fact, we were working on the other battery technology, the solid-state thin-film battery at the time. And I thought, since we were using a glass electrolyte, that we could actually use this electrolyte to build a lithium air battery, where we have lithium on one side of the glass, and we could conduct through the glass to react with oxygen from the air, which meant that you eliminate this expensive cathode material that's used in lithium ion batteries. And so the battery.
The cobalt,
manganese oxide, lithium manganese oxide, lithium cobalt oxide,
right.
And lithium nickel oxide. So eliminating those materials by using oxygen from the air for the lithium to react with in the discharge process. So when I got the idea of using the glass, and I said, okay, this will be great. But then when I started doing literature searches, I found that K.M. Abraham had done some work before, and so of course that was a big letdown. But that's okay.
But he had hadn't taken
you,
it.
You outlived him.
He's still alive. In fact, he's coming. We're good friends, actually, now. He's coming by to visit with us.
Had he taken it to the applications of which you're speaking?
The problem was that, for him to continue his work on it, he would have needed to have funding.
Mm.
And since the funding was not available, then it laid dormant, and I was able to pursue it. He had not...
Unbeknownst about him.
Right. He had not included the glass electrolyte approach with the barrier and those kind of things, which would make it practical. And the other thing that we've addressed is the rechargeability. Up until we got involved, making a battery, a lithium air battery recharge was something that all of the prior researchers, including the individual from the Army, had concluded was not practical.
And so, yet they were wrong.
They were wrong, correct. We have the record on rechargeability for lithium air batteries. We're over 100 cycles. And in a day now, we're implementing some design features that I'm anticipating will take that even higher.
Well, I say they were wrong because it's very easy in technological advancements to hit a wall and say, oh, that doesn't work, and then go off and do something else, and maybe you're wrong.
Well, part of the problem, I just didn't know any better. You could attribute it to that. But part of the problem is...
Isn't that a big part of science, though? If you just don't know that doesn't work, then you can...
Go and make it work. Yeah. Well, a big part of science, I grew up in the 60s. I was glued to the TV when President Kennedy said, we're going to put a man on the moon before the decade is out. And at the time, the technology to put a man on the moon did not exist. But the vision and the goal did exist. Mm-hmm. And so committing to that is what was important. And so I took on the commitment. And part of what the prior scientists, the problem that they had was that when they try to get someone to support them or support the work and allow them to pursue the technology, you've got managers, government managers, I'll use a kind term, who you have to convince to provide funds to that versus something else. And if they don't see the vision and see the benefit of doing it, then it's just tough to continue.
As we're doing this program, I heard today, Paula told me that Ray Kurzweil is on the cover of Time magazine next week.
Mm-hmm.
Ray Kurzweil comes to mind because Ray's one of those people who dropped out of school and just because he had some ideas, and he's made a great deal of money. He has ideas that I think are very strange.
Including the singularity, which in this cover of Time magazine is about.
But he has also he's created products.
Lots
Kurzweil
of
synthesized
technology.
Lots of things out there that he has done. So for all the people who are skeptical, and the reason they're skeptical is, A, he didn't have the appropriate advanced degree.
Mm.
B, he was working in his own little laboratory.
Right.
He was not affiliated with a university.
Right.
He was not working for the Defense Department. He was not working for the defense industry. And he was not working for one of America's or the world's major corporations.
And where he made
Therefore,
his money was on music synthesizer stuff.
Right. He had the money. What he didn't have was the institutional base. And I mention that, as you might imagine, because that seems to be the same challenge.
I mentioned IBM and lithium air, and they came out and made the announcement. There's a lot of focus on lithium air. We were having trouble getting funded, and now everybody's interested. There's a lot of buzz about lithium air, but we've been working on lithium air batteries for about 8 years. IBM says it's going to take 10 years to bring it to fruition. Well, they're not aware of the work that we've done.
Mm-hmm.
So
they're 8 years behind you.
No, actually, they're 18 years behind you.
they have big muscles. I mean, they have a lot of resources at their disposal, and they're able to influence the government. Whereas if I go in, which I did, to the Department of Energy and other places to try and get funding, and people look at you cross-eyed, as you were just describing, but IBM comes in, and it's a whole different ballgame. They're treated with a lot more respect.
Yes, and... When I read the article about you, which is how I met you, if you will, in the Atlantic magazine, it was quoting Paul Werbos, who is with the
National Science Foundation.
Well, it happened that more than a decade ago, we had done a program with him. He is one of those visionary type people, or he wouldn't be at the National Science Foundation. And he was just over the moon about you and your work, and continues to be, and I continue to follow his work as well. So there are sometimes, even in the government, there are, and when he makes statements, he's always clear about, is he speaking as a National Science Foundation person or just as a scientist,
right,
who in his own right is quite famous.
Quite accomplished, that's right. And in fact, I'm humbled when I first met Paul, and then he got excited about the engine, and he started advocating funding for it and so forth. And then when I looked up his background, I was just totally humbled, because having someone of his caliber endorse what I'm doing is just...
But even there,
Paul, with the National Science Foundation, a government insider, in trying to channel funds toward the development of this technology, ran into roadblocks and obstacles. And so, you know, the I want to call it a bureaucracy. There are many gates and hurdles that you have to cross, and most of them are Nangates, if you will, naysayers, and gate along the way, people can say no. Very few actually can say yes and bolt it out of the process. So the odds are against you. But having a technology that that was created by us and is not something that the government has been funding in the past, and so these guys don't know about it, really makes it tough.
Well, you used the word paradigm earlier, and part of the challenge I would think that you're faced with is that what you're doing is outside the standard paradigm of how new, particularly breakthrough, products come to exist. Except, of course, it's not.
Mm-mm.
Edison,
right,
didn't have any of those qualifications. What he had was the same kind of determination. I'm bloody well going to make it work, and found a way to make it work. But part of this seems to me to reflect the parochialism of the existing systems, and the fact that there are, this is the way it's done.
Mm-hmm. And the only way it can be done, therefore.
And there are a lot of vested interests.
Absolutely.
Have made commitments and gone down a certain path and stood in front of their managers and made a case for funding in this direction, and all of a sudden you're suggesting to them that they stand in front of their managers and say, well, I was wrong, and that's not the way to go anymore.
Now, you're talking...
Which takes an exceptional person to do.
Yeah. What I was going to say about that, though, is, God bless America.
You bet.
Edison and, right now we're facing a situation, the U.S. Government and Department of Energy chose to put about $2 billion into the battery industry to launch battery manufacturing in the United States, because everyone recognizes the importance of batteries to the future.
Well, and everyone, you mean in the world. This isn't just in the backyard. There's a real international thrust in
this
technology.
This is about the economy kinds of...
That's right, because, as much as we rely on oil, when you get right down to it, oil is just a medium for transporting energy from one location to another and having it available to use. So if you're going to free yourself from oil, you need a medium for transporting energy around. And batteries are a very attractive way of doing that.
So have you gotten their attention?
We're getting their attention. We're in that process right now. People are now starting to realize what we've accomplished. We were prodded into coming out of the closet when IBM made their announcement. And I said, well, wait a minute. We've been doing this for 8 years, and we know a lot about lithium air batteries. So.
Well, I want you to know a lot more about Dr. Lonnie Johnson. May I say, Excellitron, is that the big umbrella?
That's the big umbrella for the battery technology, yes.
And he does so many interesting things, many of which we'll come back to talk about in just a moment. This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. Bill Russell and I are delighted to be with Dr. Lonnie Johnson, who is right at the edge of all kinds of fantastic possibilities, some of them probabilities now in terms specifically of energy and its production and its use.
That's right. We were talking about batteries and the importance of batteries for transporting energy, and when you get right down to it, the sun is the single energy source that can supply all the future energy needs of the world in a sustainable way. The challenge is, how do you get the energy from the sun into a useful form at a cost that's practical? If you could supply energy, electricity from the sun at a cost that's comparable to what it would cost from coal, it would be a no-brainer. You know, the transition would be painless and it would already be underway. The problem is that it's a lot more expensive. And so when you want more for less, you know, you tend to rely on what you know how to do already.
Well, in fairness, it's more expensive because so much of the costs of oil are externalized. That is to say,
we don't pay the real cost.
Well, we don't pay the cost of the environmental degradation. We don't pay the cost of having armies in the Middle East.
Me getting asthma because of it.
I mean, there's a whole lot that is not internalized into that cost. And if you actually did, then the cost structure would be different.
Yeah, but we don't.
But we don't.
That's absolutely true.
And it's part of what I find so appealing about what you're doing. Is one, it appears that cost is part of what you're addressing. The other thing that I find, and I want to put this, try to put what you're doing in context, the energy challenge, particularly with so-called renewables, is converting sunlight to something that is usable today, is a challenge because typically the sun is not where you want it to be, when you want it to be, how you want it to be, 24 hours a day. Sometimes it's on the other side of the earth, which is awkward.
Actually, the earth is on the other side of the sun, but we won't go there.
Well, I'm using my friend's reference.
Well, the sun is always shining on some part of the earth.
So. That's right.
But, you know, the point is, though, that I was making, you know, is that, yes, you want to be able to generate the energy from the sun or whatever the renewable energy source is when it's available. And then you want to store it so that it's available for use when it's needed. So you need the conversion source or device for converting the energy from the sun. But then you also need the battery to store it. And not only store it locally where it's generated so you can supply it to the homes and for fixed and industrial applications, but you also then would be able to store energy in vehicles for transportation.
Can you do all of this stuff?
That's the full spectrum of what we're working on.
That's amazing, isn't it?
You know, to wrap, you know, because this may not be obvious, you live with it all day, every day. What you're doing with your heat engine is the capture part.
Right.
It can be used to take the sunlight, use the heat of the sun, convert that into electricity. The other half of that, which is what do you do with electricity when the sun goes to the other side of the world? And the answer is store it, which gets you to your battery technology.
Right.
The challenge in both of those are, you know, are the obvious challenge is cost.
Right.
Which is what presumably, well, the first challenge is, can you do it?
Mm.
And the answer is people are now doing things. There are technologies that convert sunlight into electricity,
right,
and that store electricity.
Right.
The challenge then becomes the economics,
right,
of it, which presumably,
right,
is dead center
we're
of what you're struggling
on
with.
That's correct.
So if other people are doing this too, why is yours better?
Because of cost and efficiency. You know, the automobile engine, for example, the fuel that you put in your car, the gasoline, I understand that somewhere in the range of 12% of the energy that's available in the gasoline actually makes it to the wheels to turn the wheels on your car and make your car go.
Not enough.
Not very much at all.
What's inefficient?
It's very inefficient. You know, the engine itself is somewhere in the range of 30%, but by the time you go to the transmission and so forth. So there are a lot of losses. And then
and
that's not even adding the costs and issues of getting the gasoline to the gas station and so forth. Another interesting parameter that I ran across just recently, in Iraq and Afghanistan, it costs about $400 per gallon of gasoline on the front line because of logistics and getting it there. So clearly that's an expensive way of moving energy around.
And yours?
For the battery, we will be about a tenth the cost of lithium-ion batteries per watt hour of storage capability.
When you talk about the 12% in my gas tank,
the engine conversion efficiency. The analogy I like to use is that the internal combustion engines burn fuel at about 2,600 degrees centigrade, so Carnot potential. You'll know what that means.
It's
very high. The potential for conversion efficiency is very high, but yet the actual conversion efficiency is in the 30% range. I could achieve close to 40% with an ideal Carnot engine. So if I have a different thermodynamic cycle, Carnot cycle, as opposed to the Otto cycle, then that cycle is going to be more efficient, fundamentally. All else being equal, friction and things like that, you know, you pay those penalties. The JTEC, on the other hand, does approximate the Carnot cycle, Carnot equivalent cycle, the Ericsson cycle. So it's going to fundamentally operate at a higher efficiency than the Otto cycle. Then you add in the features, no moving mechanical parts, and some of the other things that allow you to achieve higher efficiency just on that cycle. So your losses would be less.
And the JTEC is your engine.
Right.
That's what you're talking about. I want to go back to the battery for a moment. You said that the cost was dramatically lower compared
Correct.
To lithium ion. There's also the question of energy density, how much energy per unit of mass.
Right.
And I assume that is also, because those are two different animals.
The way the analysis goes is, you know, construction of a lithium air battery is not too different from construction of a lithium ion battery. You use polymer binders for the cathode and so forth, and you have electrolyte in the cathode and those things. So when you finish construction, although the lithium air battery materials are going to be cheaper, but let's put that aside for a minute. You just use a similar manufacturing processes for both batteries. When you get through putting the batteries together, and assuming that the cost is the same, essentially the same, then the lithium air battery is going to store 10 times more energy than the lithium ion. So your cost per watt hour of storage capability is an order of magnitude lower. So that's the thing that makes it very exciting and worth undertaking.
Well, and at that point, the hurdle has always been the price, as it is priced, ignoring external cost of gasoline and the amount of energy in gasoline. But ultimately, it's the amount of work that can be done by the stuff. And it sounds like what you're talking about, the technologies that you're working with, makes you competitive with gasoline.
Well, you know, actually it's better because gasoline, comparing a battery to a gasoline is not even a fair comparison because when I use the energy out of the battery, I put more energy in. When I use the gasoline, I got to go find some more gasoline. And the logistics and all of that associated with that. So the idea, if you can get the energy from the sun, a green source, plug your battery in at home and recharge it, then you're going to be much better
Which
off.
Which takes us to the JTEC.
Correct.
Which is the engine.
Correct.
So how does that work? Since we're doing a science course here today.
Well, yeah, but this is not just, there's nothing abstract about this. All of this is world-altering.
We're working, I have a team of scientists. The biggest challenge is technology, you know, we're good at that. We're bringing it along. The real challenge is continuing to feed ourselves as we move it forward.
Talk about JTEC. You were saying,
well, the energy generation part. You know, you've solved the battery problem.
Yeah. Well, the minute you say and go home and recharge it, I'm thinking, oh yeah, and then you got to burn a lot of dirty coal because I have this terrible company that burns dirty coal. I don't like them. You can like them if you want to, but I don't like them. But or anybody who's generating electricity anyway. But you don't have to do that anymore.
Well, you know, but before we people talk about, well, global warming, is it really bad? And there's this big debate going on, and it was going on before people realized that we need to move away from dependence on oil because of national security as much as anything. So the motivation is more concrete and more clear to everybody. But the issue about global warming, we can see that things are changing around us daily. People will argue, well, those things are naturally happening. We're in a solar cycle, or there's a, you know, it's bigger than just what man is doing to the earth. Well, my response to that is fine. You know, let's take the part that man is doing out of the equation, get that off the table, and then we look at what's happening after that. And if the problem is still happening, then we need to get on with addressing that one, because it's a real problem.
Yeah.
You know, and one, you know, you don't want to throw up your hands and says, okay, we're all doomed to warm. It's going to warm up, and you know, half the United States won't be habitable before long.
Underwater.
The let's get on with it. We're going to come right back and get on with another part of why this is all really exciting in just a moment. Be back with us when we are with Dr. Lonnie Johnson. Conversations with people at the leading edge. Certainly Dr. Lonnie Johnson is one of those people. Bill Russell, I'm Paula Gordon.
I want to say sometimes we use that in a metaphorical.
Oh, no, not this time.
Very, and with no apologies. Sometimes leading edge to us is historians who tell us where we've been so we can cope with where we're going based on what we should have learned from that. In this particular case, no qualifiers.
Yeah.
This is leading edge. The work that you're talking about has the potential of changing
everything.
Life on Earth. All life on Earth. Or
hopefully,
sustaining life on Earth.
Hopefully for the better.
Indeed. Indeed.
That's my assumption. That's, you know, and I think most people, those who
Indeed.
Don't have direct economic interest or ego interest in other technologies, I think most people would agree that's the case.
And why is this? Because it would unplug us from oil?
Well, ideally, absolutely. That's the goal.
Well, what I wanted to talk about next is there's, okay, we've got this engine. Okay, we've got a way to store the energy that the engine, and you could put people to work. And
absolutely.
Your commitment to putting people to work at home, often in neighborhoods that need work. Talk about that, because this isn't you're a mad scientist off inventing this and that. You're also a real human being who understands that there's more to life than being in your white lab coat or making money or solving puzzles. There's this important other additional third piece, isn't there?
Absolutely. You know, this all ties back to what we were talking about earlier about developing nations lifting their populations out of poverty and trying to improve the quality of life around the world. And the last thing you want to do is end up bickering over dwindling resources. You need to have an energy source that's abundant enough that you can support all the growth that humanity is presently facing. Everybody starts to understand where we're going and what needs to happen. And even more profound, you know, if you leave a population behind, and they come through this process late, and we've seen the kind of turmoil, strife, fighting, the danger that occurs when a large group of people feel like they've been exploited or taken advantage of or just left out.
And many of them have in this world.
And they come back to haunt you. So you have to really address that and bring everybody along.
In addition to which, you don't have to do it just over there. You can do it right here.
The challenge we face, and we have gone through a period of time where it made a lot of sense for business leaders to outsource jobs to other parts of the world, China in particular. China is a juggernaut. It's coming along very aggressively in terms of its growth. It's consuming a lot of energy, and that's part of why you see prices going up. But more important than that, they've come up the food chain, if you will, in terms of technology and know-how. So the skills that are over there now are really at a level where they can challenge the U.S. So we have to figure out how to remain in a leadership position economically and create jobs for our own population. I mentioned the $2 billion that the government's put into battery technology to create battery manufacturing in the United States, and that was a wise choice. I do feel that more of that money should have gone into the kind of work that we're doing, because that's the next generation. Now, leadership in the U.S. is beginning to realize that that's what should have happened, because to spend that, even though it's a lot of money, is actually modest to the stakehold that China, particularly Japan and Korea, have in lithium-ion battery technologies. So you can't just come in and take those markets and take that know-how when those countries have years of experience and market outlets and control and dominance in those areas. So the best play for the United States is to go the next generation beyond and establish leadership in the next generation of technology, and also the intellectual property, which is what we focus on, of course, that will allow us to maintain a foothold and enable us to establish leadership while the other countries are starting to play catch up to us for a change.
It's I think, important to say that these countries that you mentioned and others, it's not just their commitment to make more TV sets.
Mm-hmm.
They all view this as their economic future.
Absolutely.
This is a highly competitive...
This gets back when you think about the oil industry and what that means to the world. This is envisioned as a new way of transporting energy. So batteries are our future. You know, that's what's going to... They're going to power the economy.
If the United States, based on your or similar technology, is able to commercialize, let's say a lithium air battery, that's very good for the economy. That's good for labor markets. That's good for manufacturing. It has all sorts of potential impacts that are critical to the economic, everything else aside, to the economic well-being of this country.
That's absolutely correct.
And the same thing with respect to the JTAC, to the engine.
Yeah, because when you think about what I was saying about batteries, and the evolution is starting for batteries to start becoming more and more prevalent in the energy sector. In fact, using batteries to store energy from green energy generation sites, wind power stations, solar power stations, storing the energy when the sources are available. They're starting to evolve, and people are beginning to realize that a better technology is needed. If we can bring that new technology to fruition first, then we gain leadership. We're able to create jobs here in the United States for our population. I think that it's also true that this next generation technology will be manufactured worldwide, but we want to be the ones to control that.
Well, and one of the obvious challenges, I mean, moving from prototype to production,
right,
is always a main challenge, and particularly given the last several decades in this country, I think anybody looking at this would have to say, that's great, wonderful technology, and we'll end up having it made in Vietnam or India or China
or Bangladesh
yeah. or Albania or Slovakia or someplace not here. And I would
Which
think,
is a bad idea.
Well, it's from the American standpoint, it certainly is not an appealing thing. You're aware of all this. How do you address that?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's very easy to say great intentions, but when it comes down to 50 to cents here, a dollar here, which
right.
am I going to do?
That's right. Well, you know, that's an interesting dilemma. But there is an answer. You know, we were talking earlier about how many people it would take to do a certain task. With technology, the number of people needed gets reduced. The productivity in the United States is at an all-time high, even though the number of jobs are low and a lot of people have lost jobs. It's because of technology. We can do things a lot more efficiently now. So as that happens, what we really need is for technology to enable other things that are not presently possible so that you can create, so that you produce a lot more things with the same number of people, as opposed to producing the same number of things with fewer people.
So
if the world is available and you can supply a product economically using advanced technology, then you don't need to have the job in a cheap labor market. So the technology itself, which has been the way we've eliminated jobs, could be the source of creating jobs and more prosperity.
You also have the advantage, I'm just thinking of the pure economics of this, if the money is not going to Saudi Arabia and Russia, and bless their hearts, Canada.
Places that have oil to sell.
Is here, not there, and can be applied.
I think that's a more fundamental problem. Because we've shipped so much of our wealth out of the country in order to bring energy in, we've been facing some challenging times. So solving that problem will have a very significant impact.
Did you finish your idea about, you were saying the technology itself could generate jobs because your technology is more advanced? And I just want to make sure you finished that thought.
Yeah, the technology itself, and this will create additional jobs because you can make more product for more people with the same number of people as opposed to making the same amount of product with less people. So if you do the same job, you don't need as many people to do the same job, then there's no growth and you've actually eliminated jobs. But if you can use the same number of people and produce more and have markets for more and sell more, then you're able to ship product out, bring wealth in, and all of a sudden you reverse the dynamic that we've been facing.
You care about that, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
Putting people back to work or even to work.
I want this to happen now.
Yeah.
For a whole host of reasons. You corrected me. You've got prototypes of the batteries, two different types of batteries. Right. Which presumably, gets you moving towards, thinking about production, how to implement that. Where are you with the JTEC, with the heat engine?
And you can think about that while I take a quick break, and we'll all come back in just a moment. This is the Paula Gordon Show. We'll be right back. Join us. We're back. Dr. Lonnie Johnson, Bill Russell put to you, where are we in the JTEC in terms of it happening now?
The JTEC is not as far along as the battery, unfortunately, but we're working on it. I alluded earlier to being able to feed ourselves and get support. One of the challenges with the JTEC, again, was that we had to develop some new materials that didn't exist before. We use proton conductive membranes in the engine.
You would use
proton conductive membranes, membranes that will allow hydrogen nuclei to pass, be conducted through, stripping the electron off and sending the electron through an external circuit.
I can't buy that at the grocery store, can I?
Well, but you can buy it in a fuel cell because that's what fuel cells use. That's how the hydrogen comes in. The proton goes through the membrane. The electron goes out through an external load, powers a light or an engine, a motor or whatever comes, to complete the circuit. After the proton gets through the membrane, what's driving that process is that the hydrogen gets reconstituted. It reacts with oxygen and produces water. So the hydrogen-oxygen reaction is what generates the power in a fuel cell. In the JTEC, we use pressure, hydrogen pressure, to push the hydrogen through the membrane to generate the current. So as opposed to a chemical reaction to drive the engine, we use pressure. And remember what I said about how an engine works. You compress a gas at low temperature, heat it up, and expand it at high temperature. So we use these proton conductive membranes to conduct hydrogen across and pressurize it at low temperature. Then we go to a high temperature stack and expand it at high temperature, and we get more voltage out and power out at the high temperature expansion than it takes to compress it at low temperature. And so the membranes that are used in fuel cells, however, don't have the material properties that the JTEC needs. The membrane that the JTEC needs to be a high barrier membrane that does not let the hydrogen diffuse through, because that would be an efficiency loss. The pressure could actually push hydrogen molecules through without them changing to protons. And so we had to come up with a membrane material that would not allow that to happen. And it also needed to have high conductivity in a dry hydrogen environment. the material that's used and most popular for fuel cell is the material called Nafion, which is made, uses water, and it has to be wet in order for it to conduct the protons. And the J techniques operates better when the environment is dry inside.
You know, I sit here listening to you, and I'm kind of doing a yo-yo. Is this guy a scientist? Is this guy a businessman? Is this guy a visionary? And the answer is yes. That really, at this moment in time, with the challenges we face, and with your wonderful mind able to wrap around all of these things, are you able to distinguish for yourself, who am I today?
Well, I know what parts I like.
But
you're also not doing this by yourself.
Right.
Well, I have a team of scientists, obviously, that, you know, the JTEC idea, the genesis of it was mine. We have a scientists who are working together with me to help bring this to fruition. I'm fortunate to have a team of scientists that are, I would put up against anybody in terms of their technical prowess and abilities, any team. I would like to think that the technology and the caliber of the technology is what has attracted these guys to and to remain so loyal and helping to bring this technology to fruition.
Since I first came across this engine, I've been dying to ask you, because I understand in general the physics of it. What I've not looked at is the equations, and I'm not sure I'd make sense of them anyway. Does this operate? Does it require high temperature, or is the temperature differential that makes the engine possible?
It's a temperature differential.
Which means this can be applied any place. It could work in the Arctic. If you had something, you know, a human body that was warm, the difference between that temperature and this temperature would make this engine feasible.
Actually, you could.
So this is more than just solar energy.
Now, the efficiency, of course, and the amount of energy that gets converted depends on the magnitude of that temperature difference, the efficiency. When the temperature difference is small, the efficiency is smaller. So the higher temperature, which is what makes it attractive for solar, because you can get some very high temperatures from the sun, which means that you can convert in the 60-70% range with the technology. But absolutely.
But it does open other options that have not been explored before.
Not only that, the engine is a thermodynamic engine, meaning that it can operate in reverse. You can actually use it as a heat pump for refrigeration and temperature control. So now
it's just turned upside down. I'm sorry.
Well, operated in reverse.
Moving parts. I go back to that in and of itself. The no moving parts thing is a gigantic step, isn't it?
That's very significant. The only thing that was comparable to this is conventional thermoelectric technology. You may be familiar with thermoelectric converters based on the Peltier or Seebeck effect. These are solid-state semiconductor devices. But the efficiency is very low. They're in the single-digit range, whereas the JTEC is a totally different ballgame.
Does it wear out, or do we know yet?
Don't know yet, but there's nothing obvious that would suggest.
Everything is reconstituted.
There's no moving parts to create friction in that sense, so you're not talking about bearings that will wear out.
The membrane, does it get oversaturated with potassium ions or something?
You know, what's intriguing about it, one of the things intriguing about it is, you know, we were actually out at the National Solar Energy Laboratory, Sandia National Lab, a few months back, and during the meeting, one of the scientists there mentioned the fact that solar cells are very attractive because they're all solid state, they're highly reliable. The problem is that they're expensive because the efficiency is low. On the other hand, the Stirling engine is attractive because it operates on a thermodynamic cycle, so the efficiency is high. But it's expensive because it's a mechanical device and it has a life cycle maintenance cost that you have to factor in. So you have on the Stirling engine, expensive because it's mechanical and low reliability. Solar cells expensive because low efficiency, but the high reliability. The JTEC is in the middle with the best of both worlds. It's an all solid state device, so it has a high reliability of the solar cells, It has high efficiency because it's operating on a thermodynamic cycle like the Stirling engine. So ideally, you've got the best of both worlds in this technology.
I get the sense that I should wrap this up with what Dr. Cornell West has on his answering machine. Stay strong.
Thank you.
Dedication, imagination, hard work, and a commitment to his community characterize Lonnie Johnson's career. History is littered with ideas that didn't work out or were too far ahead of their times or which lost out to competing, often inferior, technologies. Even if Mr. Johnson doesn't win, he has dramatically altered the game. We hope he succeeds. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.